All right, 1 Samuel, we find that the redeemed request a king after their own heart, and certainly God grants them that with certain provisions, which he has outlined already in the book of Deuteronomy, but is reiterated. By the way, every one of those are going to be broken before we get done with our study of 1st, 2nd Samuel, Kings, and the Chronicles. What we experience in 1 Samuel is the birth of the kingdom. We see the expansion of that kingdom in 2 Kings as we are introduced to Solomon, David's son, the expansion of the kingdom. David is certainly a key element in Samuel and part of the Kings. But the redeemed become disobedient. And because of that, there is a division. And a division in the kingdom because of their disobedience. And then a little bit later, the redeemed, the Judah alone, the southern kingdom, becomes corrupt, disobedient, rebellious against God, completely refusing to give heed almost to anything that God says, going over into idolatry. And so because of that, the redeemed are brought low into captivity. Now that, by the way, is 1st and 2nd Kings, as we have described the totality in just a short summary there. When you look into 1 Chronicles, then you have God's sovereignty with regards to the redeemed. God is the King of Israel, even though there is Saul and David and Solomon, and then all of these minor kings in regards to the northern and southern kingdom. God still reigns sovereign over his kingdom, and that is one of the things that 1 Chronicles really develops in regards to its theme of redemption. And then 2 Chronicles addresses the question why the redeemed end up into captivity. And 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles will end basically with the same event, and that is the destruction of Jerusalem. And so in this series of threes. That is, we went with Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, and then we have Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. And interestingly enough, we begin this with Samuel. Think about the history and the events that have taken place. We begin Samuel with the prophet, the judge, Samuel. And then we end with the destruction of Jerusalem. The beginning of the kingdom, the first seven chapters unfold the beginning of the kingdom. And then by the time you get to the end of this section, 2 Chronicles, you are at the kingdom. The Jerusalem is destroyed. The temple has been annihilated, and all of the items within the temple have been taken back to Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar has destroyed the city of David, the city of God. The kingdom has been taken into captivity. And so when you think about this particular section, I'll admit that in all of these lessons thus far, it has been hard to really deal with the book itself because there are so many events, so many great historical events that need to be discussed in the New Testament church today, that we need lessons dealing with these things today. And so often, It is my desire to pause and to deal with that more in-depthly, and I know that we cannot if we want to maintain what we have set forth in our Bible study schedule to be able to do. And so My job is not to deal with every event. My job is to deal with the book itself. And so when you when you look at Samuel, that is 1 and 2 Samuel, the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, if you was to look at three items within there, Smith identifies three, what he refers to as poems or more poetic discussions of redemption in regards to 1 and 2 Samuel. And he says that this really gives us the key to those two books. And he addresses the prayer of Hannah in 1 Samuel chapter 2. And 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse number 10 in particular, especially as it relates to looking forward in that messianic kingdom to that great Redeemer, Jesus Christ. And then there is Nathan's oracle in 2 Samuel chapter 7, where David's, even though David sins, David is promised a light that shines throughout Israel. And so we see in Nathan's oracle here, or in his prophecy, we see that which the New Testament identifies as the New Testament church, as the reign of Jesus Christ in 2 Samuel chapter 7. And then as you conclude Samuel, you come to David's addresses in 2 Samuel chapter 22 and 23. And we've already at least identified 2 Samuel 23, where he talks about the mighty men of David and the fact that Uriah the Hittite was a part of this. But if you look at the first five verses of that, again, you see that, and we go all the way back to David at this particular point, to where David is identified and his last words are given. And so those three items Smith identifies as, if you want to see the redemptive story in 1 and 2 Samuel, that those three, the prayer of Hannah, the oracle or the prophecy of Nathan, and then the last words of David, especially in chapter 23 and verse number 5, are important items in regards to that. And so there's a lot of information in these books, and when you get to 1 and 2 Kings, it doesn't slow down at all. The events just keep building up here. In fact, let's just take a few minutes. 1 and 2 Kings. What are some of the items or some of the major events that automatically come to your mind as we just think of 1 and 2 Kings, or the book of the Kings? Okay, you're going to have, in this time period, you're going to have the division of the kingdom. Okay, before you get to the division of the kingdom, the first half of 1 Kings is all about the building of the temple itself, Solomon's temple. It takes up a huge portion. What is it? Chapters 5 through 9, chapters 5 through 8, chapters 5 through 9, takes up a huge portion. Josh and I were talking the other day just about the temple and its relationship, all of the items in the temple, and how important, if you just overlaid the Old Testament temple with the New Testament church, that every one of those items have a particular and important aspect in the New Testament church. So as far as the ideal of redemption and the redeeming kingdom of the New Testament church, there is an overlay there. And so you have the kingdom that is being spoken of here. What else? Okay, you have you have Jeroboam and Rehoboam there. You have Rehoboam's foolishness and Jeroboam's rebellion, And there is an entire chapter that we should be very well aware of in 1 Kings concerning not just Jeroboam's rebellion, but, and I think this is what Josh has in mind, but the establishment of that northern kingdom and how he went about to establish that in complete defiance against all that God had just granted him. Which amazes me because in two chapters prior, he is referred to as a valiant man in Solomon's court. He is a valiant man, and yet, even in spite of that, he is going to completely rebel against all that God has set up. Listen, he knows what he's doing, as far as keeping the northern tribes away from the southern tribes. He knows what he's doing politically, socially, but he has to destroy the spiritual aspect of God's kingdom in order to do so. And so there's an extremely valuable passage there that we should pay real close attention to in the New Testament church. What else? Say that one more time. You know, again, Josh and I were talking about that just the other day. He said, have you ever considered the evolution of Saul? I was thinking maybe of a different word, the de-elevation, de-evolution of Saul. But the way that evolution describes evolution, it's almost a de-evolution anyway. But that's beside the point. But yes, there are two chapters in the lives, one of Saul and one of David, in 1 Samuel 15 and 2 Samuel, oh, what is it, 12, 11, excuse me. Oh, did you say Solomon? Hang on just a second. Y'all watch it. You're not supposed to put your fingers in your ears, but I need to put mine in there. My apologies. But, by the way, it works with Solomon as well, doesn't it? Well, no wonder y'all were like a deer caught in headlights or something. But no, I'm glad you did. It's one thing to look like a fool for a few minutes, but to go through that the whole class without being interrupted would be really silly. But no, Solomon does the same thing basically. He ignores the blessings that God has given him in regards to that, and he chooses to do things his way instead of God's way. With all that wisdom that God had granted him, he still chose his own way. 1 Kings identifies when it talks about that. What is that? 1 Kings chapter 10 identifies the transgressions of Solomon. In that, the Bible specifically says, here's God speaking to Solomon. Even though I have spoken with you or appeared unto you twice, in other words, God was saying, it was beyond his thinking that Solomon would ever get to this particular point. Yes. You know, it's interesting, and the difference between, and this is really the idea of Israel choosing a king after their own heart with Saul, and God giving them a king after his own heart, is how David responds to being confronted with his sin, and how Saul or Solomon respond to that same thing. Saul, you remember, began to make excuses. He blamed everybody but himself. It was never his fault. The people wanted this and the people wanted that. Well, we only chose to do this because we wanted to enhance our worship to God when he's speaking to Samuel. Solomon just did it anyway. Regardless of whether or not he was rebuked of God or not, he just chose. He was wise enough to direct his own kingdom, oftentimes without God. God said, don't stack up for yourself a whole bunch of horses, right? We dealt with, don't go, it's not about the horses, it's not about the chariots. And guess what? Every one of those things. And yet, David, when confronted with his sin, we see a tender heart being produced out of that rather than a rebellious heart. He certainly demonstrated a different character than you would expect a king to have. And by the way, did not we see that in even in his even in the when he was chosen by God? And he, Samuel, God had to point out to Samuel, I'm not looking for the countenance. I'm not looking for a king that looks good, that looks like a king. I'm looking for a man who will act like a king. Exactly. And that particular section, Samuel is being instructed on what a king should be instead of what a king should look like. And, excellent point. Well, yes. Asa went back and forth. Jehoshaphat, same thing. Jehoshaphat, by the way, Asa and Jehoshaphat are both described by God in their epitaph as good kings. But that does not mean that they did. This is, I think, one of the key elements to demonstrate the inspiration of God's Word. God never hides the sins of His people. You know, this book, if it was written by Israel, about Israel, would not be so hard on Israel. Okay? If you're writing your own biography, it's going to be a whole lot better than somebody else writing, right? Okay, yeah. Sennacherib's brag rock, right? Yeah, And I believe the ideal of that sentence is, we came to Jerusalem, we besieged it. And that's basically the end of the sentence. In other words, it left off as if it was going to end, or did end, the same way as all the other, we came to that city, Samaria, and besieged it, and then we overthrew it. Exactly. And by the way, God, this, to me, this is one of the great things about God's Word, is think about this from our vantage point, just looking at these stories. Who do we identify with more generally, Peter or Paul? Most people say Peter. Now, some would say Paul, but most Peter. Now, why? Most people, when asked why, would say, well, Peter made a lot of mistakes and Jesus forgave him. Okay. So we get to see, we also get to see, not just the sovereignty of God over the affairs of men, but we get to see the compassion of God in the affairs of men. Mm-hmm. maybe what we should have learned is the older we get, the more crankier we get in our ways. No, 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 no. That's a different lesson. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yes, sir. Oh, okay. Well, if we're looking at overall, his was early before he became a disciple. Peter was back and forth while he was a disciple, and that's why I use that analogy. But by the way, some would choose Paul. But he was a murderer, a blasphemer, he says, in the beginning. He identifies himself in that fashion. Right. Right. And that's not true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll go to Rome, but you'll go in chains. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I bring that up just to illustrate the fact that most of us, when we look into Israel and God's dealings with Israel, there are times in which we say, how did God put up with such a wicked, immoral, obstinate, as he himself says, they are a stiff-necked, uncircumcised people. But aren't you and I glad that God doesn't give up on us after one sin? And so I think there are great lessons that we can learn from this particular section. The first 11 chapters of 1 Kings, by the way, we're back to the redeemed are divided because of their disobedience. What we see is Solomon in his reign in all of his glory. There are several things that I would love. I have an entire sermon on just 1 Kings chapter 1 and the death chamber of David. It's to me, this is a beautiful scene. David is dying. He is losing heat. There's a young lady that is brought in just to be able to give him heat. So that he could live his last days in some sense of comfort. And yet the affairs of the entire kingdom are still upon him. And in and out come prophet, come priest, his wife comes in, Nathan, Bathsheba, Zadok, all Benahi, all of those come in. The captains of armies come in, and then you get down to chapter 2. And in chapter 2, the first maybe 3-4 verses there, powerful transition between David and Solomon. And Solomon gives some advice to his son. I saw a movie one time that I almost threw a brick through the television when I saw it. If I'd had a brick, I might have, but luckily I didn't. It was about the life of David, and they come to the very end of his life. They're showing this very scene of Solomon coming into David and the advice that David gives to Solomon per Hollywood, per television, or the movies was, don't listen to the prophets. And I thought, I pulled out my Bible and I'm flipping pages here and there and I'm like, wait a minute, here's the scene they're talking about. So it says, now in the days David drew nigh that he should die, he charged Solomon his son saying, I go the way of all the earth, be thou strong therefore, but show thyself a man. By the way, he said, don't listen to the prophets, do what feels right to you. Boy, if that ever isn't a modern message, I don't know what is. He said, keep the charge of the Lord thy God, to walk in His ways, to keep His statutes, His commandments, and His judgments, and His testimonies, as written in the law of Moses, that thou mightest prosper in all that thou doest, and whithersoever thou turnest thyself, that the Lord may continue His word which He spake concerning me, saying, if thy children take heed to their ways, to walk before me in truth, with all of their heart and with all of their soul, there shall not fail thee, he said, a man on the throne of Israel. Moreover, and then he starts dealing with some other matters of the kingdom, but in just completely opposite of what was actually said there. And so don't get history from Hollywood. And especially when it revolves around biblical history. There is nothing sadder on television than sitting down to your television to watch the History Channel about something biblical. Because it'll take a shred of truth and make it into a complete lie. But that we've gotten off on that. But this is the transition between David and Solomon, and it's an important item. And now, again, we know of the desire of Solomon to be a good king, of his desire for wisdom, to rule over the people of God, as he should, and God's granting of that, and he didn't desire gold, he didn't desire fame, and so God granted him all of those things. Now, what I want to do is to turn your attention even beyond the temple. I'm really tempted to just, let's spend the rest of our time right here at the temple, but we're going to move on from there. I want you to be able to see in 1 Kings here, I want you to be able to see chapter 11 is the transition, the last of Solomon's days. And there's going to be a transition in chapter 12 from Solomon, the united kingdom, to a divided kingdom. For almost 120 years, there has been a united monarchy over Israel. And with just a slight variance, by the way, those 7 years at the beginning of David's reign, where Saul's son reigned for those 7 years. And outside of that, you've had a united kingdom. And here, because of the foolishness, number one, because of the wickedness of David's sin, you do have to go back to 1 Samuel chapter 12 and Nathan's response to David's sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah to get some of this. And then you have the wickedness of Solomon and his rebellion. And then you have Rehoboam's foolishness and Jeroboam's rebellion. All of those are four aspects that work into this. But I do want you to notice a couple of things that is stated in 1 Kings chapter 11. At the very end of verse number 4, let's just pick up with verse number 4. Verse number 4, chapter 11, 1 Kings. And it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. And so here is a difference that divine writer wants us to know between father and son. At the end of the verse 6, and Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord, as did David his father. Again, it's not saying that David never sinned. What it's saying is that David's heart could be turned back to the Lord, and Solomon's was not being turned back to the Lord. Look at verse number 9. And there's a lot in between here that we're not getting to that's important. The wives that Solomon intermarried that wherein he was forbidden, the building up of the temples of these idols, and then Solomon even worshiping these idols with his wives. But look at verse number 7. Verse number 9, sorry. And the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. I have that noted, in my head. He appeared unto him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing. God said twice, Solomon, this ain't the direction I want you to go. Stop. And Solomon chose not to. And so it says, and thou should not go after other gods, but he kept not that which the Lord had commanded. Wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon, for as much as there is done of thee, and thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee, and will give it unto thy servant. By the way, if you go back chapter 9, then you find that that servant is Jeroboam. Okay, and there is a visual parable that takes place before Jeroboam, where a garment is ripped into 12 pieces, and he is given 10 pieces, which would represent the fact that he was going to rule over 10 of the tribes of Israel. Now, again, God is investing in a man to do the right thing, and he chooses not to. Yes, sir. There are times that I don't know about Solomon's repentance in regards to these things. I hope that the last thing that Solomon ever wrote is Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 11 and 12, where he learned to fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. I hope that, at least that's my hope. I don't know. Rarely do we get glimpses into eternity, right? We do with Abraham, because paradise is described as in the Old Testament as Abraham's bosom. We do with Elijah and Moses, right? Because they're transfigured before the Lord on the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew chapter 17. There are times which we get glimpses of that. Here we find, after David's death, an epitaph of David. With Solomon, I don't know that I've actually found that epitaph. Now, somebody in here may have information that I don't have on that. That's the beauty of a Bible class. is that the teacher don't always have all the information. Sometimes he is as much the student as the teacher. Yes, sir. Well, I'm going to leave that kind of judgment in the hand of God. Now, listen. If Saul was continued in his rebellious state, even to death, I would say yes. But if a man repents, I know that God is a willing God to forgive. And so I'm going to leave that up to him as far. Now, Dante tried this, by the way. You can read Dante's Inferno. And I think he had a list of everybody, even during his day, that was going to be in hell and everybody that was going to be in heaven. I don't want to come up with that kind of list. Now, I know certain men will be there and certain men won't. But the eternal judgment on a man's soul, that's not my category. He did commit suicide in his last act. Yes. So take that into consideration. But I'm going to leave those things in the hand of God in regards to that. Now, suicide there are matters of the mind that I may not understand in some suicides, but self-murder is considered a sin. Okay? All right. Where are we at? The dividing of the kingdom. Do what? Jeroboam and Rehoboam and Solomon setting up this scenario. And remember that David warned him. David said, you listen to God and there would be a perpetual line of David upon that. You listen to God and here it identifies that he did not. But verse number 12 is interesting to me in this scenario. He says, now he's chiding Solomon. He says, wherefore, verse number 11, wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon, for as much as this is done of thee, thou hast not kept my covenant, my statutes, my commandments, which I will surely rend the kingdom and will give it to thy servant. Notwithstanding in thy days, I will not do so. I have underlined the next phrase. It has nothing to do with Solomon. I'm not going to take it away from you, Solomon, because of David. You see, it had something to do with the character, the integrity, the promises that God made to David. He said, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son. Howbeit, I will not rend it always. I will not rend all the kingdom, but will give one tribe to thy son for David, my servant's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. And again, the southern kingdom becomes the southern kingdom. Judah alone is what the kingdom is going to be referred to after the divided kingdom, and then after, 722, when Sennacherib comes down and takes the children of Israel, the northern kingdom, away. It's Judah alone. Now, Benjamin is also included in that. Benjamin chooses with that and becomes really a part of Judah at that particular time. There are distinctions, but they really become more or less one tribe at that particular time. And so Solomon multiplies and does everything that God has asked him not to do. And so there's a division that takes place in regards to this. Now, in chapter 12, I know we're quickly moving out of time here, and a couple of phrases that are underlined in my Bible again, this same scenario. Verse number 32 of chapter 11. But he shall have one tribe, he's reiterating that promise, he shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake. At the end of verse number 32, it's as did David his father. In verse number 34, for David my servant's sake. Verse number 36, he says, unto his son I will give one tribe, that David my servant may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen to put my name there. And then there are some qualifiers on some things. And he says in verse number 38 and verse number 38, and it shall come, and it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and wilt walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my covenant as commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with thee, and will build thee a sure house, as I built for David, and I will give Israel unto thee. And again, the commandments are not kept. That's why you have a division in the kingdom, and that's why you have ultimate captivity. And I would suggest whether or not we are talking individually within our lives, or whether or not we are talking about collectively as a congregation, that these principles are valuable principles for us to learn. That if we continue in disobedience, there will be a division between us and God. between the righteous and the unrighteous. And with continued disobedience, there is enslavement and captivity. Now, chapter 12, we really get into the center of worship of the northern tribe. Just a couple of things I want you to note here in regards to this and the division of the kingdom. Dan and Bethel are going to be set up in verse number 28 as the place of worship where God had specified. Remember he said, Jerusalem, where I put my name? That's where worship, the collective worship of Israel, was to take place. But Jeroboam knows that if the people keep going back to Jerusalem, that their heart is going to go back to Jerusalem. And so he does not want that to happen. And in order to keep the people on his side, he knows he has to have a different place of worship. And so he describes for Dan and Bethel. Now, on a map, I think you probably looked at this. Dan and Bethel are at the southernmost and the northernmost part of Israel's kingdom. And so there's a great deal of convenience in their worship. It's not just one place. You can go north or south. It does interest me where God prescribes one, how often it is that people want two. Whether it be one God, whether it be one mediator between man and God, whether it be one place of salvation, the New Testament church, whether it be one plan of salvation, I mean, we could go on and on with God's ones and men wanting more than what God offers. Even though God is more and what God offers is more than what we will ever need, we still choose to want more, and that's the way man-made worship is all about. And so in verse number 31, he chooses the priest. In chapter 12, he chooses the priest that, by the way, are not according to the tribe that God has assigned. By the way, the Levites are they're the tribe of the priest, but not so here. Verse number 33, I think, is probably a key verse that you need to have underlined. Maybe even memorize, be a good verse to memorize. So he offered upon the altar, which he had made in Bethel, the 15th day of the 8th month, even in the month which he had devised in his own heart. Everything about this worship is a devising of Jeroboam's heart. And it's sad, and it should sadden us. It should oftentimes bring us to tears that there are not only religious people in the world, people that want to be right with God, that are being deceived into thinking that they can be right with God by worshiping after their own heart. But even worse than that, my brethren, are when members of the Lord's church are doing the same thing. Yes, sir. Absolutely. You know, and it's interesting. Now, God had another place of worship in the beginning, right? It wasn't always Jerusalem. Shiloh, right? Shiloh was the first place of worship after they crossed over. But when they were done with Shiloh, he says, Jerusalem is my place where I want my people to gather. And it is interesting that they would choose these places, and at the northern and southernmost points of that. There's so much that I really want to get to, but we're not going to be able to get to. But yes, ma'am. And by the way, that's the appropriate response, isn't it? That's the response that we're looking for in God's Word when we see sin and error all around us. Is when we can see. You know, some people, when it gets too far, they say, I never intended to go that far. Those priests, those Levites, they didn't intend to go that far. And so they know they've gone too far, and now they've got to go back. That takes a great deal of humility to be able to do that. Yes, sir. Isn't it interesting that they chose a calf as well? Something I remember about Moses and Aaron with calves that they probably should have went back and read the book. But not only that, the convenience of it, right? Oh, it's too much. Yeah. At the very beginning, he took Jehovah God out of the picture, didn't he? Listen, I'm telling you, reading the Old Testament is an extremely valuable lesson for the child of God. More than we can get to in one 40-minute session. All right, James, you got the Chronicles and beyond.